From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Julia Pierpont's new novel of infidelity and divorce, every family member has their own way of dealing with the family breakdown. Young Kay Shanley, 11, writes Seinfeld fan fiction that gets as off the rails as her father's steamy, illicit emails to a mistress. Everything comes apart. Jonathan Safran Foer helped guide the book, so did Zadie Smith. But anyone who's been through a family divorce will recognize the trail. This hour on Point, Julia Pierpont and Among the 10,000 Things. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you been down this road? Do you know the terrain? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, the new Dr. Seuss book pulled out of an old stashed away box. What pet should I get? But first, joining me from New York is Julia Pierpont, debut novelist, author of the new book, Among the 10,000 Things. Julia, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You started this very young. You were still, were you in undergrad or in grad school when you started this book?
Yeah, I was in graduate school by then. Fall 2010 would be when I started the book.
You're 28 now, so you were 23, 24, something like
that. Who knows, yeah. It was a couple of years after college.
Presumably you weren't married then.
Nope, still not.
And had not been through infidelity or divorce yourself.
Correct. I mean, yeah, not in that way, no.
So how did you zero in on this? Did you grow up with it?
You know, it's funny. I never thought of it as an odd subject for me to choose at the time that I was writing it. I hadn't been through anything that specifically, that was not an autobiographical story for me. Mm-hmm. But I think I just knew I wanted to explore these themes of betrayal within a family and the way in which that can lead to sort of a Rube Goldberg of breakdowns within relationships. And betrayal was just really what I wanted to explore. And the adultery just kind of was the lens through which I wound up looking at it.
Heck of a lens, and it starts out with a bang. I wonder if you would read for us right from the beginning of the book. Visualize this, listeners. It is in italics to signal us that we are reading over someone's shoulder. We are reading a letter.
Dear Deborah, do you go by Deborah? It sounds so uptight. I bet you hate Debbie. I hate Debbie too. Jack calls you Deb. This is a letter about Jack. I began sleeping with your husband last June. We were together for 7 months, almost as long as I've known him. We did it in my apartment, or I went to his studio, a lot. One time at the Comfort Inn in Midtown last August. He used his Visa, look it up. I know about Kay, her getting bullied at school, and I know about when Simon got caught shoplifting at the Best Buy. I never asked to know about your family. It's just that sometimes he needed me.
Julia Pierpont reading from Among the 10,000 Things right from the top, and boom, there's the grenade right off the bat. Deborah is, 41 or so? Jack is early 50s?
Early mid-50s.
Kay, 11. Simon, her brother, 15. Mm. And here comes this letter. I guess Jack has tried to move away from the younger woman he was having an affair with, and she's not happy.
Yeah, this is one of the dangers of the internet now, I think.
Dangers
you don't
of
the, have to keep, yeah.
Don't have to keep what, sorry?
You don't have to keep a diary anymore to have a full, record of everything that you've done that you shouldn't have.
We should say this letter comes on top of an enormous stack of emails, a pretty very steamy, often sexual emails that they had exchanged. That she drops off at the apartment building on the Upper West Side where the Shanley family lives. And young Kay, 11, sees a little, it's not really taped shut. There's a little pink showing through it. Maybe it's a present for her. She is the first to read into these, and then along with her brother, and then boom, 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 everything.
Yeah.
Everything comes apart. Did you have the beginning at the beginning, Julia, or did you dive in somewhere in the middle of this and figure out how to set off with such a bang?
Yeah, you know, I really did. I was lucky to have stumbled upon it. I didn't know it took me a long time to admit that I was writing a book. For a long time, I referred to it as the book-length thing. I think that's what I saved it as a document on my computer for a long time. It was a blessing in a way because I'm not someone who generally is comfortable outlining plot, and that's not usually what comes first to me. So it was lucky that I got to this thing that really did sort of dictate. I felt sort of just like I was following what had to happen next.
In some ways, Kay, the 11-year-old, is at the heart of it. I mean, she makes the first discovery, and somehow she remains the observational rudder, though not the narrator, throughout.
Yeah, that's true.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, in part, I would say that of all the characters, she's the one whom I actually have been in her position. You know, I just
an 11-year-old girl at one point.
Yeah, I've been there. And she's such a sensitive, careful, sort of shut-off person. I mean, part of the reason I gave her this device of writing this fan fiction, she writes the Seinfeld fan fiction, as you mentioned, is because she's otherwise not really going to let us in on what's going on in her head or not consciously going to think about it. So that's a hard character to tap into when you're writing, you know, a close third. And so I wanted her to have some sort of a creative outlet, and she just is the quiet one and the watcher, and I guess in a lot of ways that's sort of the writer in a lot of places.
The father is a conceptual artist, kind of a sculptor, but in a very high concept fashion. The mother, a former dancer who's now teaching ballet. It emerges that she's 10 years or so younger than him, and that she first took up with him when he was in the midst of an earlier marriage, almost as though there's divine retribution here or something. Is that what is that what you intended?
A little bit of that. I mean, that's certainly part of it, that what goes around comes around kind of idea. But I think also it's a way of making everyone's hands dirty in the situation. You know, she has this great fear that her kids are going to judge her for if they make that discovery. So everyone has something to lose. No one is completely innocent in this situation.
Can you read a little bit more for us where the mother, Deb, the box comes to her ultimately with all these very steamy sort of sexual exchanges between her husband and a young mistress. Her children have already read deeply into it. She knows that, and now it's in front of her.
She didn't even look at most of it. That was something Simon couldn't believe, how his mother didn't pore over every page. As furious as he was with his father, he was furious with her too, for reasons he couldn't yet explain, but had something to do with how her reaction was not enough, not nearly enough, though he did not know what that would be. This is a letter about Jack. This is a letter Deb held against her lap in case her hands wavered. I began sleeping with your husband last June, and Deb began feeling grateful her children could not see through to her stupid heart, how it lurched there. It's just that sometimes he needed me. You get migraines, right? He told me you do. From Kay's bed, she lifted her face to where her son was standing, defiant with his arms crossed, defiantly not crying, and where her daughter was shrinking into the wall trying to press through plaster.
Again, Julia Pierpont reading from Among the 10,000 Things. It has been very warmly received. The story of betrayal is one that people know in lots of different ways, from their own or others' lives. The close observation here is really wonderful. There's humor as well. It's not just suffering, though. There's plenty of suffering. I wish you'd describe for us the act of imagination that went into each of these. In some ways, I guess they must have each been individual projects for you. Looking through Kay's eyes, the 11-year-old girl's, through Simon's, the 15-year-old son's, through Deb's, the 41-year-old wife, and Jack, the 50-something husband, artist, runaround guy. What was each of those challenges like?
Well, I certainly had days devoted to each of them. You know, I would work mostly in the library, and I would get there and know, you know, today's a Jack day. And I would sit down with my computer and a bunch of books usually that I would read sort of before I started writing that just kind of got me in the right mindset or kind of triggered something that would make me then want to write. And also it was actually a great way to trick yourself into pretending you're not there to necessarily write. If you don't feel like you can just read. But I remember reading a lot of Dennis Johnson when I was working on Jack, for example, or I remember reading, you know, Philip Roth too while I was working on him.
And just sort of that man's perspective on
that masculine sort of swagger that Jack has that actually made him really fun to write.
He says, it's not like I killed anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't. He has a way of seeing the best in himself.
Maybe way too easily. What about Deb? She's 41, and the mother of the wife, she's kind of crumpling here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Deb is a hard character too. She was one of my harder characters, I feel like, to write, because she is trying so hard to do the right thing in most of these situations, and she doesn't usually say the right thing, and that's just something that happens a lot in families. And then, you know, her career is sort of a sore spot too in their family, and I wanted to sort of address that as well. She was a ballerina and sort of walked away from it to have kids, but it's not so clear that she actually gave up a great career. It seems like maybe she cut it off before it became clear that it wasn't going to work out as well as it could have. And I just was very interested in working on exploring a character, any kind of athlete really, where their career is so heavily weighted to the early part of their life. And so it really was a choice. It wasn't as though she could come back to that later.
But as you say, almost as though she used marriage and children to walk away when it wasn't quite on the trajectory that she might have dreamed of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's something that I remember being really affected by when I read Yeats's Revolutionary Road, is there is that idea that you can't always face pursuing your dream for the fear that you're not going to achieve it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fine-grained detail of divorce, that emotional odyssey of a family taken through the ringer, as told by debut novelist Julia Pierpont. Her new book is Among the 10,000 Things. People think and talk a lot about divorce, whether it's between the covers of this book, her first, or here's a little bit from a March TED Talk entitled Rethinking Infidelity, a talk for anyone who has ever loved. This is relationship therapist Esther Perel.
We have a romantic ideal in which we turn to one person to fulfill an endless list of needs, to be my greatest lover, my best friend, the best parent, my trusted confidant, my emotional companion, my intellectual equal. And I am it. I'm chosen. I'm unique. I'm indispensable. I'm irreplaceable. I'm the one. And infidelity tells me I'm not. It is the ultimate betrayal. Infidelity shatters the grand ambition of love.
Shattering the grand ambition of love. Julia Pierpont has taken us through all the shards of one fictional relationship. Let's go to Kai, calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Kai, you're on the air with Julia Pierpont. Thanks very much for calling.
Yeah, I'm having a very, very hard time, a difficult time hearing you right now.
We hear you loud and clear, Kai. What do you think?
Okay, I'm thinking that you're asking me what my point is. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, in my situation, my parents, they went through a divorce with a case of adultery the similar case where my father, you know, kind of tipped away. And it just seems like everyone is the victim in this case, where I kind of sensed that my father, he didn't feel like he was the man, or it was like he was not a strong figure in our family, which made him want to go out and seek other people. And my mom, she's, of course, the victim because she, was tipped out on. She was the one, you know, that felt, you know, betrayed in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
We were all kind of pulled into this, and it was a horrible fiasco.
How old were you, Kai?
I am now 33 years old.
How old were you when this all unfolded in your family?
This happened probably when I was in high school, so this was maybe around 96, 97, 98.
High school, so more like Simon, more like the brother's age in Julia Pierpont's story. Kai, I appreciate your call. Julie, what was it like to try and imagine the difference between a girl at 11, a boy at 15, trying to take this on board, especially when their eyes had kind of been seared by reading these, hubba hubba emails?
Yeah, the ages are so important here. I mean, Simon is at an age where it's all about him and how is this affecting his life, and Kay is still very much more attached to the family. Simon mm-hmm. is caught up in the high school social ladder and everything of that nature. And if his friends have divorced parents, then he might as well too, and it's not a big deal. And then so they actually kind of really can't see eye to eye in it. Just the difference of those 4 years really, really separates them. But I was also I was thinking about that, what Kai was saying about so many victims. And it's interesting to me. Another reason I wanted to explore these family dynamics is you can have a victim that then sort of becomes a culprit. You have, I think you see in a lot of cases, in this case, the way that Simon sort of rebelled against Deb early on is you have anger at the parent who mm-hmm. allows themselves to be the victim in the situation.
Yeah.
And so they also become guilty in that way.
You're very clear about that. So is he, certainly. We mentioned how Jack, the father, looks at it. I wish you'd read a little bit of his sort of perspective as the author tells it in Among the 10,000 Things.
The kids, they treat me like I'm a stranger. He was still on the floor. Well, you've made it very hard for them to feel like they know you. I've ruined everything. His voice was flat. He had made so many mistakes. Maybe her own was to think of the past, or maybe the past was not to be discounted, but she could feel it softening her. She used to do okay on her own. More than that, only after she'd met Jack had she ever felt really lonely. Lying awake on that awful twin bed in her first apartment and him asleep for barely an hour beside her, she thought she'd made a terrible mistake, loving. She'd wanted to go brush her teeth, but that would have meant getting out of bed with his warm body, and she hadn't gone. She thought about what she would say next. It was a bit of a gift. But hopefully they could get over it. Jack nodded as if to say yes, he'd thought of this. They were kids. Their hearts were open still. There was time to make it up. And you? Deb was in the tub, which was a boat, and Jack was on the floor, which was an ocean, and she had to decide if she would let him drown or bring him aboard. Maybe. She had to be practical. If he swabbed the deck, she thought. There was so much hair in the drain.
Julia Pierpont, getting it right down to the hair in the drain there. All the detail, ladies and gentlemen, all the detail. Pamela, Hampton, Virginia. Pamela, you're on the air with Julia.
Hi, Julia. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, from my experience, I was married for about 12 years, and my husband had come back from a deployment when I found out that he cheated. I saw a text message in his phone. Mm-hmm. And I was really angry about it, and I was super hurt, but I decided to stay with him only because my hatred for the other woman was more than my hatred for him. It's like I didn't want her to win because I felt like she would be taking something from me. So it was kind of, oh, you think you can take my husband? Okay, we'll see. You had him for a while. So I think that was the motivation in the beginning for me to stay with my husband because I didn't want someone to take something from me.
How did that work out, Pamela? How did that work out?
It was difficult because it was a lot of resentment still there, and I was just trying to hold it together to show that I was stronger, and it just didn't work out very well. We're separated now. We're not divorced, but we're legally separated.
Yeah. Pamela, I appreciate that angle, and you're calling in with it. And Julie, there's a long, more than a moment here where where the wife, Deb, knows. She overhears her husband on a phone call in the bathroom at his mother's house in Houston, and she essentially knows that there's something going on and decides just to live with it for a time. I'm not sure if it's to defeat the other woman, but or that she just doesn't want to rise to the challenge of acknowledging it all. But you can't hold that once the kids know.
Right, yeah. I mean, relationships, adult relationships are so complicated. Marriages are so long. People compromise and forgive each other or try to forgive endlessly. And sometimes it's a practical decision, too, or you want to be married, so you find a way to make it work, or this person gives you something else in your life that, you know, maybe it's not what one would expect, but it's good for you. It works for you. You have a way of working around it. And it's just that we don't teach our children that. We can't. They kind of have to figure that out on their own as they grow up. So there is this issue once the kids find out of what am I condoning here and how are they going to understand that once you have these kind of young idealistic witnesses that have been told this whole time to live a certain way.
You were doing this, you were starting off here as a student when you began writing. Zadie Smith, the great British novelist, had a workshop. You were in it. You were first writing for her, I guess. Jonathan Safran Foer, great New York novelist, thesis advisor, New York and beyond. What advice did they give you as a newbie setting out on what turned into a pretty darn good first novel?
I got some really great advice. I remember Jonathan told me, I was very, like I said before, I was apprehensive about committing to a first book. There's so much pressure, I think, if you're writing a first book to have it be about the right thing, choose the right subject. And I remember him telling me to relax a little bit and that I won't accidentally write a whole book or a whole 300 pages or however much about something that bores me. You know, it just won't happen. You will end up following the story to what interests you about it, wherever you start. And that gave me a lot of freedom to go with my first impulse and just see where it led.
What about the write what you know advice that first-time writers often get? This was not autobiographical. This was not your family's story, even in a camouflaged way, as I understand it anyway. Did they say, watch out, be careful, or go for it?
No, there really wasn't that, because I think there's so much in there that is. I mean, even if you're not writing a memoir, you're not writing an autobiographical story, there's inevitably when you write, there's going to be so much of yourself in it. I'm able to relate to all these characters. So I am sort of writing what I know. It just doesn't seem that way, I think.
That's sort of the bigger knowing. I mean, so many of these details could be in any family. You bring them, though. This is sort of all the little creaks and groans and moments. I guess you can bring them into the arena of a family meltdown, and they work just as well there if you pair them up with the right moment in your story. Heidi in Boscobel, Wisconsin, you're on with Julia Pierpont.
Hi there. Hi. Love your show, Tom.
Thank you.
What a fascinating topic. I wanted to call in and comment. When I was a 13-year-old girl, I came across some letters from my mother's lover. And I'm 45 now, and over the span of my life, I know it's affected me greatly in so many ways, but I didn't tell my dad for 2 years, and there was this unraveling of the family fabric that was, you know, terrifying and fascinating, and being kind of, you know, in the spot I was at, you know, developmentally, it was just a real ride. And I meant to call in because I found this topic to be so fascinating. It's not discussed, and I'm so curious to read the book.
Heidi, did you feel guilty when you were not sharing what you'd learned about your mother's love letters with your father, or did you feel more guilty after you told him and the family broke up? Did you feel responsible in some weird way?
Absolutely responsible. Absolutely. I felt that if I would have told him sooner, I understood the magnitude, even for being a young girl. I understood the magnitude of what it all meant, and I couldn't say anything. And my father and I had a relatively close relationship, so I was very protective of him, too. But, yes, and sometimes to this day I still think, oh, what if? You know, what if I never would have said anything, if I just would have burned those letters or thrown them in the garbage?
Yeah.
Or
Julia, this is pretty close to your 11-year-old Kay, 13-year-old Heidi. I wonder what's going through your mind, novelist Julia, with Heidi on the phone.
Well, I totally understand that idea. I think, you know, there's that fear where what if they don't want to know? Even, you know, you tell somebody something they don't want to hear, that turns out. But you couldn't think you'd actually did anything wrong. I mean, I understand from that perspective that you would, but there is a certain responsibility, I think, too, and I totally understand that's a terrible thing to struggle with. And yeah, my characters weren't sure what to do with it either. It's actually Simon who was the one who was able to take it to the parents. Kay really didn't know what to do. She was 11, and I think she had more of that. She was a little more unsure and a little more careful and thought maybe I shouldn't say anything. And Simon is a little bit older and a little bit angrier and felt a little bit more entitled to some justice. And so he was the one that was able to reach out.
But I can imagine that if in your telling, if she hadn't shown Simon, she had to show somebody, I guess. But if she hadn't, she might have kept a secret like Heidi. It was just too much.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's a terrible, but that's such a burden to have to hang on to for so long.
I wonder about the difference between love letters that Heidi might have found, you know, a few decades ago in Wisconsin, and the way we put those together, and email or text exchanges, mm-hmm. and the way those are constructed these days. You have them getting pretty graphic in a big mm-hmm. hurry. Maybe love letters, I'm sure they were graphic too, but yeah. maybe there was a little more flower
probably
and bouquet
also,
in there.
Yeah, more complete sentences probably, more capitalization and grammar than you probably see in a lot of online conversations. But yeah, I mean, I think there's something in my book about how not remembering that people used to talk that dirty, and maybe it's just because they weren't writing it down. And there's something about typing things on the computer that makes it feel invisible and less personal.
I wondered that you went with email instead of text messages because I guess they needed to be printed out, and email's a little easier to print out for the first piece of your book.
Yeah, it's a little easier. And in a way, I think computers are a little bit more private than your phones.
Yes, you might hope that it's in the midst of an affair that it's out off bounds. Kelly in Boston, thank you for calling, Kelly. You're on with Julia Pierpont.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted, this is a really good topic and sensitive one, and I experienced something similar probably to the younger sister in mm-hmm. the story that when I was around 10, I had a trip with my father while the rest of the family was away, and lo and behold, his mistress joined us under the guise of a work trip. And later, when we got back, my father actually asked me to lie to my mother about that, and that was just the beginning of the end, and it totally deteriorated my relationship with my father. And eventually they did divorce, but it got very messy because then he cheated on that first mistress with somebody else, and it was pretty messy. And I know people can't control who they fall in love with, but I do think there are certain rules of engagement, even when you're messing things up. Like, I was always intrigued how they had this sense of entitlement. You know, the first mistress almost thought she was my mother, you know, and she was the wife and had the right to be angry and acting out and taking it out on us. So she proceeded to just hurt us as a family, not so much my father.
Maybe one rule of engagement should be don't ask the other person's daughter to keep it, to become an ally to the infidelity. Dads, don't ask the daughter to cover it up for you. Kelly, I appreciate your call right there. Julia Pierpont's new book is Among the 10,000 Things, all kinds of fine-grained detail about what happens to her fictional family in the teeth of divorce. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fine-grained detail of divorce, the emotional odyssey of a family taken through that ringer as told by debut novelist Julia Pierpont. Her new book is Among the 10,000 Things, and it takes you through in very fine detail of how a family comes apart in the wake of an infidelity that is exposed in a kind of stunning way at the beginning of the book. Lots of ways of responding. This was season 6, Mad Men on AMC. Trudy, played by Alison Brie, confronts her husband, Peter, played by Vincent Kartheiser, about his affair with a woman in their neighborhood.
We're done, Peter. This is over.
You want a divorce?
I refuse to be a failure. I don't care what you want anymore. This is how it's going to work. You will be here only when I tell you to be here. I'm drawing a 50-mile radius around this house, and if you so much as open your fly to urinate, I will destroy you. Do you understand?
Okay, there's the nuclear 50-mile radius way. Julia Pierpont starts out a little more gently. Julia, I wish you'd read a little bit here where the mother, Debbie, is walking to school with the kids and tells them, you know, people make mistakes.
The trial by dinner had not been a total catastrophe, but it had helped Deb to make her decision. And the next morning, on the walk to Simon's subway station and Kay's school bus, she wedged herself between them to talk about what next. Again, she found herself using old standards, the cliches like, people make mistakes, and wondered if the kids recognized them as such, or if she could get away with it because of their ages. Were they too young to know the words were rewarmed? What your dad did has nothing to do with the two of you, she said at the corner, barricading them back as she looked both ways. It isn't about you. It isn't even really about me, she added. Did she believe that? Mostly it's about himself. Okay, Simon said, knocking into her arm as he hopped off the curb. Your father and I have been married a long, long time. People make mistakes.
And you can just feel the children trying to take that on board in Julia Pierpont's Among the 10,000 Things. Michael's calling from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Julia, I finished the book yesterday, and I thought it was terrific. Okay. And I just wanted to ask you, because of what I thought pushed Deb over the edge and made her take the kids and flee to Rhode Island, is when the Seinfeld letters or episodes were made known to her by the teacher when they were stolen off the bus. And I felt that that piqued her anger, and she gained some clarity. And I thought that at that point, prior to that, she was feeling that the marriage may be able to be saved. But at that point, I thought that she gained clarity, and she just said to herself, this is over. It's done. I got to get some time and space and get my kids out of here. And I also thought that another quick point that my viewing of the book, I thought that the women were much more likable characters than the men were.
Michael, I appreciate your call. Julia, what about likability? Did you think about it at all?
You know, I have that problem that I think a lot of writers have where they like all their characters a little more than most readers end up liking them. So I found something to like in all of them, but I certainly understand Jack, you know, Jack and Simon are, Simon is just 15. That's really Simon's biggest crime. But Jack is a difficult person and someone I do have a lot of empathy or at least sympathy for at this point, looking back at the story and how his story turned out. But I agree with your first point about that what made Deb go over the edge. There's that moment where she realizes how Kay is being affected by this and how that she's letting her children get hurt, and this is evidence of it. And so she has to make a move right there. She realizes she's not succeeding in shielding them from it, and she doesn't even know what's going on in their heads.
Kind of breaking moment. Kay is writing this Seinfeld fan fiction, sort of kind of as if a Seinfeld episode, but a whole lot of sexual stuff from her father's exchanges with his mistress is coming into it, and these bully girls get a hold of it, and her daughter is vulnerable, and they are out of there. There's been a lot made of the fact that midway through the book, you sort of break the timeline and flash way forward and sort of tell us how it all works out in the end, and not so well and happily. And then we're back into the grain of it. What led you to drop that couple of pages in where, if you want to know what happens years from now, well, here it is, but now back to the story.
Right, yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in works that deal with time and the way it makes you think about your day-to-day life differently. You know, people always, in stories, they stay together until they don't, or they're happy until they aren't. And people have their eyes so often on what the conclusion is that they sort of pay less attention to the day-to-day and that thing that I called between time in the book that turns out to be most of your whole life. And if you were to know how things ended, how would you behave differently now? If, you know, that's something that I've found very compelling, and I was hoping that this structurally was a way to communicate that, where you find out everything that happens, but then you really have to look at these characters with new eyes. They seem sort of faded. It's sort of a mourning of the end before it's happened, mourning the future.
Yeah. You've done well. You came out of the NYU MFA program here, had a bidding war for your book before you were, I think, before you were even out of school. What have you learned from this one, Julia, that may guide your next?
Well, it's been amazing. You don't really write thinking that you're going to have so many people read your book, or anyone. You know, they live the characters live on your laptop for so long, and it's amazing. The first readers that came back, it was strange. It suddenly felt like these people really knew me, you know, or I wanted to get to know them because I felt like they knew so much about me after having read the book. And in some way, it's still that way. I don't know that it's very difficult to grasp the idea of any number of people sitting down with your book for that long and reading it and connecting with it. That's a whole other thing.
It's very intimate, both writing it and
really
then
is.
Sharing it, I guess.
Yeah, it really is. It's hard to wrap your head around in a certain way.
Do you think you'll stay in that zone of family intimacies next time out, or, I don't know, write about the
sure
Wild
yet.
West?
Family is a good topic, I think, for me. Just, I mean, you know, those are the strongest bonds we have and the hardest to walk away from. And in most cases, we get just one. So I don't know yet, but I wouldn't be so surprised.
And Julia Pierpont's first book, It All Comes Apart, is told with a really wonderful, wonderful, close, fine-grained examination of how everybody in the family acts and responds. Julia Pierpont is author of Among the 10,000 Things. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Julia, thanks so much for being with us today. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Great to have you. In a moment, we'll look at the new old book out from Dr. Seuss. For many years, the fantastical worlds of Dr. Seuss have dazzled readers. The Cat in the Hat, Green Eggs and Ham. Now, from an old box in La Jolla, California, a new Dr. Seuss book, What Pet Should I Get? It's out today, found in the old personal effects of Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss. Joining me now from New York to tell us how it all came to light and what's there, Kathy Goldsmith, Vice President, Associate Publishing Director at Random House's Golden Books for Young Readers, former art director for Theodore Geisel, or Dr. Seuss. She colorized the black and white art that he had drawn for the latest to come out, the new one, the new old one, What Pet Should I Get? Kathy Goldsmith, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Donald Pease is here, professor of English and comparative literature at Dartmouth College, where he is the Ted and Helen Geisel, third century professor in the humanities, author of the biography Theodore Seuss Geisel. Don Pease, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
So first to you, Kathy, if I may, how exactly did this come to be, and how did you come to be coloring in the black and white drawings that look so familiar to us from Ted Geisel's other books?
In October of 2013, we got a phone call from Audrey Geisel, who is Dr. Seuss's widow, and her assistant, Claudia Prescott, who was also Ted's assistant when he was alive, to say they had found a box of materials in the house, and they thought we ought to come out and look at it, that we would be very interested in what was in the box.
And what was found there?
Well, among other things, we found the virtually complete artwork and manuscript for the book, which we now call What Pet Should I Get?
And was it, in fact, complete, front to back, all done, ready to go?
When we first saw it, we were not 100% sure of that because we only had about a half an hour with it the first day we saw it. But yes, in fact, we did have all of the cover, the line art for the cover and the interior of the book, and we had the text for the interior as well, which was in pieces taped to the artwork, which was Dr. Seuss's way of working.
Don Pease, when you see what's ultimately come out here, is it clear to you as a scholar of Ted Geisel, Dr. Seuss, that this was intended for publication?
Yes, I think he intended it for publication after he could return to it from the work that bears such a striking resemblance to it. One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish,
yeah.
In which many of the same predicaments have clearly been resolved. That brother and sister have a house full of creatures that you wouldn't find in most pet stores, but that are of a piece
yeah.
with the yent, the thing on a string that flies around the head of the boy, and that tall thing that will fit in a box. The relationship between the creatures the children can imagine and what's on offer in the pet store constitutes the deep premise of the book and one of the central premises of all of Dr. Seuss's art.
Kathy, describe for us what goes on in What Pet Should I Get?
Well, as we have the story of a brother and a sister who are, in fact, the same children we see in One Fish, Two Fish, who are in search of a pet and who head off to the local pet store, which is where you bought pets in the 1950s, to find a pet of their own. And their choices there are many, and the problem is they have a problem making up their mind, as we all do, children and adults in life, that we often have choices that are hard to make. And I think that Don is right when he says that I actually think this book was written right before One Fish, Two Fish. I think that Ted moved from the part of this book which is about the imaginary pets and moved directly into One Fish, Two Fish, which is really about imaginary pets, almost immediately. So I think that's the link between the two books. But I think that, like so many books of Dr. Seuss's, while we're nominally talking about the decision of which pet to choose, we're really talking about how to make a choice when you have more than one.
The off-screen dad here has said, look, choose a pet, but choosing a pet is a big challenge. And you've got the kid saying, you know, the time may be now to make up my mind, but who knows what other good pets I might find. It's got that Dr. Seuss rhythm to it right away. And, of course, the pets start out as recognizable dogs and cats and fish, and pretty soon you've got all sorts of wild things running around here. Don Pease, what was the big project of Dr. Seuss? What was he up to with this great unleashing of imagination? Was it just fun? Did he have a project, a goal in mind?
Well, think of the time in which it was written. It was a time that coincided with social unrest from 1958 to 1962, and it was a time in which that disturbance in the social world animated, I think, the most profound creative resources in Ted Geisel. And around this same time, he's producing Yertle the Turtle. He'll produce the work, The Sneetches Against Racial Intolerance, and Green Eggs and Ham, which is also against constructions of biases. And both What Pet Should I Get and One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish indirectly deal with that unrest by celebrating the capacity to acknowledge change, to celebrate diversity, to recognize that figures you can't quite categorize are perhaps the ones you want to welcome most in your world.
Yeah. And what took him to children at the heart of everything, Don?
I think, you know, prior to becoming a children's book writer,
mm-hmm.
Ted Geisel wrote propaganda art for PM, which was a popular front tabloid designed to get the United States into war. So he had to draw upon the aggressive drives, the need to reduce people to caricatures in order to have the United States recognize those enemies as real targets for military combat.
The Japanese, the Germans in those days.
The Japanese, the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
But after the war, he wanted not only to get that aggressive mentality out of his art, he also wanted to bring it out of the minds of children. He wanted to teach children after the war to live in a world in which they did not need to condition their laughter or their humor around targets of aggression and adult hatreds. And this book, along with all of the books he creates, designed to call to adults' attention the instinct for fairness and social justice that Dr. Seuss believed was innate in the children imagination that he drew upon and that fostered his drawings.
Kathy, you brought the color to these black and white drawings. That's a pretty powerful case for what was going on here that Don makes. We just got 20 seconds. What's the spirit you felt as you were coloring in Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss's drawings for What Pet Should I Get?
Well, I took my inspiration, obviously, from One Fish, Two Fish, since I think the books are so closely related. But this was a time when Ted was just moving out of using a limited color palette in his books, and a couple of years later would be using a full color palette. So I sort of hedged the two, and the backgrounds are all fairly matte and flat, but the kids and the animate objects have real colors in them, and I think it sort of straddles the divide between one section of his work and the other section.
Everybody will recognize, as these creatures go more and more fabulous, the absolutely unmistakable hand of Ted Geisel, Dr. Seuss. Kathy Goldsmith at Golden Books for Young Readers, Random House, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And Donald Pease at Dartmouth College. Thank you, Don.
My pleasure as well.
We'll go out with a little bit from the musical Seussical, Oh, the Things You Can Think. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Think a beautiful slop
with a cherry on top.
You don't need an excuse.